say that the people here are magic. They say that the people here have magic in their eyes. Look into their eyes and you'll see a brand new world shining in the distance. They say that the people here are magic. They say that the people here have magic in their hearts. Look into their hearts and you'll see the light of love shining. Of some distant time ago, the time many years ago when magic was the way, a way of life.
So welcome again, and just for the sake of those who've just come in, I'm Neville, and this is Mary, and we're your guides on this day course about moving from attachment to love. The reason that that song seemed to be a good one to play at the beginning of this is that it was written by Mama, and it was written at a time in the early Yagya when they had a sense of the magic of transformation very intensely experienced. They had had to fight to get free of the customs and systems of their tired old society. Some of them had had to wage huge battles to join the Yagya, and then when they got there, they found that with Brahma Baba and the power that was coming through him, they were able to be transported into a different realm altogether. It was a years of trance, of dancing with Krishna, of real magic. Some of the sisters going into trance for days on end. We have many stories like this. Some of the sisters recall that in those 14 years of the Yagya, there was no Maya. That's how they speak of it. Others have a different recollection, but for some, especially perhaps those who joined as children, they remember it as a time of no Maya, because there was just, Baba had given all his wealth to the sisters who were running the Yagya, and they didn't have to work. They just did things for the sake of it, but they didn't have to go out to jobs. They did have children to look after, but that was done in a kind of communal way. And Baba used to, Daddy Gulzar has these memories of how Baba used to sing them lullabies as they went to sleep at night, and when they woke in the morning, "Awaken, my princess, awaken." He would sing like this to them. It really was a world of magic. And that there was a line in that song written by Mama, where she said it was something like recalling a way of life when magic was a way of life, that the song was casting our minds back to that or forward to it, a world where magic is a way of life. And it seems like a very interesting thing to look at, because sometimes we might feel, well, this old world isn't quite so bad. You know, there are families, there are people with hopes and ambitions, there are pockets of happiness, there are concerts to go to. Sometimes artists work magic for us. They can transport us into another world, but it's temporary. But we might feel that it's not really so bad, but then when you contrast it with the kind of a world, not just where there's plenty, where there are jewels and golden palaces and this kind of thing, but a world where our minds are so free that we are actually creating the world that we want to live in. We're not prisoners of our past in any way at all, but actually creating moment by moment a paradise. When you kind of really feel that, it starts to make you feel more, perhaps, ready to let go of this life, because ultimately, that's the ultimate attachment to this life that we have now. And Baba's teasing us away from that gradually, so that we can, even whilst remaining alive, we can learn how to have our minds beyond. I remember Daddy Janki has made a very good job of this in her life, which is why she's so radiant and so powerful. And I remember years back, she was visiting a flat that I was staying in, and I had an Australian brother had come for a few days, and he had a piece of music called "It's Tumbling Down." I don't know if any of you remember this. It was recorded in Australia. And it was a sort of sad song. It's about how how that land had sort of been invaded by low consciousness that had swept through its purity, and everything of old and magical had been destroyed. And the refrain in this song was, "And it's tumbling down, it's tumbling down." And I kept coming back to this. And the last couple of minutes of this recording was a long piece of didgeridoo. You know the didgeridoo instrument that makes this sort of rumbling noise. David plays it here sometimes. And it just went on for 2 minutes as if like an earthquake. And like, and it ended up with,
like, you know,
yes, in a way, yeah, like Jeff Bubba was mentioning, yeah, but very kind of down. And so we played this when Daddy Yankee was visiting one evening, and we said, "What did you experience with that song, Daddy?" She said, "I went straight to the Golden Age." It's an interesting lesson. You know, that's the magic, that she has the power to work. And Mama did too, but Mama did it in a different way. Mama detached so quickly. They say that when she, partly, you know the story, that Mama had lost her father. He'd gone bankrupt. Then he'd had a heart attack and died, because it was big shame, you know, in the Indian community. And her mother was distraught because she was left with penniless. And she and Mama went to live with an aunt. And then that aunt's husband went bankrupt and he had a heart attack and died. And so there were these two widows in constant floods of tears. And Mama was in this environment. And one day the mothers heard about Baba and the Yagya, and they went along to meet Brahma Baba, and they came back all smiles. And Mama was so amazed by this that she went and met Baba, and Baba immediately saw her potential and said, "Do you see yourself as the future Lakshmi?" And she said, "Yes, Baba." And within about 18 months she was already Mama. She was only a young girl, but everybody, because she detached so quickly, helped by those circumstances, she detached so quickly that she very rapidly... Could you... I wonder if you could ask... I think it may be okay, but... thanks. Or if we can close those doors slightly. Yes, thank you, that'll help. Thanks very much. So Mama, aided by those circumstances, really detached so quickly that she radiated this magical truth that lies at the core of all of us, but which is covered over by our various attachments. Attachments to the whole range of things that we'll be looking at today. And she did it so quickly that everybody kind of looked up to her, and she had that role of Mama almost from the beginning. But it included a detachment from this old world so total that it was almost like there was no role left for her. And she died young. She died at the age, I think she was 47 when she died. Very young. And there's a story that she was travelling with Nivere Bhai and I think Ramesh Bhai once. And they saw a big advertising hoarding, which was something like a bottle pouring something into a glass.
Coca-Cola.
Was it Coca-Cola? Right. So it was pouring something into a glass, and the brothers said to Mama, "Mama, look at this advertisement. It's beautiful. We could use something like that to indicate the soul filling from Baba." And Mama said, "Mama has no interest in things of this world." So she really didn't even have that kind of interest in things that could be useful in service of that kind. She was just focused on leaving internally. And a huge power came through her, through that role, but it's not the only role. This is the point that I'm wanting to introduce, that Each one of us has to find out within ourselves what we are most comfortable with, what feels right for us in our journey from attachment to love. The goal is that we become pure love. We can probably recognize quite easily that when there is attachment, it gets in the way of our love, because if we're frustrated, if we don't get what we want, if there's a loss, anything we're attached to externally, there's a danger that we may suffer if it's taken away from us, or if there's a threat of it being taken away from us. So we can see the wisdom of moving towards a very detached state, because it releases our love and our happiness. However, there's a task to be done. The Yajna didn't end with Mama. It didn't end with the 14 years of that early enclosed state, when they all thought the world was about to come to an end anyway. That helped them hugely to detach and to generate that beautiful inner power. But 1950, the money was running out. They had to leave Karachi. They came to Mount Abu. They had a desperate poor period, the beggary period, when they had nothing. And one of the brothers wrote a little book that I recommend. It was Dada Chandrahas. You can get it in the bookshop. Beautiful little book. Very, very honest about those Yajna years. And he writes that two things I remember he wrote. One, it was really important that some of the mothers and daughters had to fight free of their family circumstances, because in some ways he was saying, I think that the abusive behavior that they met, because some of the families were outraged and they imprisoned the daughters and they beat them and they shoved pig's meat down their throats, all sorts of awful things happened. But he said that that actually completely broke their attachment to their families. So those abusive behaviors had a purpose at that time in helping to create those very strong individuals who became the foundation of this incredible movement. So it's just, you know, a comment along the way that everything has a purpose, and it's well worth remembering. Then again, when Dada Chandra has said, when they ran out of money and hit this beggary period, it forced them to leave Brahma Baba. And he said, otherwise they'd never have left him. They loved him so much. Yes, they were loving Shiv Baba too, but they identified Shiv Baba and Brahma Baba so much together that they would never have wanted to leave. It was like a seed that had been germinating in that hot house, you know, the 14-year period, growing very powerful, but then something was needed to kind of break it so that it would then start spreading like a seed does when it's ready, start spreading across India. And that's exactly what happened. The beggary period enabled that to happen. So the thing is there that what sometimes seems like difficult, tragic events all have their place in this drama. And our ability to negotiate these is the secret to a successful confluence age, along with recognizing that everything has its place. So there was that period when they needed to be in a hothouse separate from the world. That's when the seed of new consciousness was planted. That was essential, because there were so many pressures trying to destroy them, really. It's also one reason, I think, that they came in a land that was actually to become a Muslim state, because the Hindus were the ones who were most against them, because they were outraged by the challenge to traditional family values, when Baba was saying that the sisters should be celibate, whether they were mothers, whether they were married, whether they were daughters. And this outraged the Hindu leaders. But the Muslims actually protected them in those early years, amazingly. So did the British. Some British judges also found in the favour of the Yajna when there was a court case brought against them, arguing that they investigated. They said these people have a pure motive and they are trying to do something good for the world. What you're arguing that it's creating havoc, you're the ones who are creating havoc, he said to the people who'd been protesting. So these things, These things happened in that period of time. Then a new phase began where the sisters went back to their families in some instances, and from there they started teaching. They came like angels, some of their family members said, after that 14 years. Just incredible power. And right across India these centres started springing up. And the thing is that during those times it wouldn't have been so appropriate. It wasn't the time anymore for that closed consciousness to be developed. Individuals might do it, but the movement at this time now was expansion. And when Brahma Baba died, I think there were just there were already 300 or 400 centres, but that's nothing. Then during Daddy Kumarka's period, overseeing this incredible expansion with such love, such detachment, but with love and engagement too, it went to about 8,000 centres now. An amazing, amazing development. When Daddy Janki went outside India, she came out with this passion to reproduce for us outside India what they had experienced from Brahma Baba inside India. She had this passion. She wanted to hold God as much as she could into her mind and her heart so she could show us this truth in the same way that Brahma Baba had shown it to them. Are you with me? This was a wonderful gift that Daddy brought for us, but it also entailed a kind of a dedication that was more like the early days in the early Yagya. Daddy created a little mini Yagya where she created these souls who kind of surrendered themselves fully to the Yagya and who then became pillars for it across the globe. And then a phase of expansion from there starts to move out where we have to all learn how we best fit in with this. And this all entails, it's not that you have to compromise your part, you have to decide what is right for me on this journey from attachment to love. Because we all have attachment. We have attachment to our bodies, we have attachment to people, we have attachment perhaps to the BKs, we have attachment to our children and all of these things. But definitely it's my experience. And I've been quite a slow learner, but I've seen that as I transform my attachment into love, life becomes a real joy. And it doesn't have to be like a sannyasi, cut off. There was a time for that, but it doesn't have to be like that now. We can be out there in the world, and that actually feels to me like this is the call of the time. That we should be showing the beauty of a light and loving life to the world, in our jobs, in our relationships, not cutting ourselves off anymore, unless you feel that that's what you want to do. Some individuals have that part, but I think the call mainly now is for us to be demonstrating to the world the beauty of a detached but loving life. Would you agree with that? Are you with me? This feels like, it's a shift. For me, it's something of a shift of understanding, because I think when I began 33 years back, I just fell in love with this beautiful vibration that I met in the Brahma Kumaris. I didn't understand the Gyan for years, but my soul recognized the beauty of this new consciousness. And so I sort of fell in love with it. But that's not actually real love. Falling in love isn't real love. It's not mature. It's okay. It got me going. But real love really understands and only gives. It doesn't need. I was really quite needy in that earlier period. But the sooner we become whole in ourselves through taking everything from Baba, the sooner we're able to really be lovely examples to our friends, families, work colleagues and everybody else. And this is really what I wanted to share today, that sometimes we can think of attachment as being detachment as being cold or aloof or, just forgetting. But it's as if Baba wants us to hold it inside ourselves that this old world is finishing, and truly understand that a world of magic, of a huge spiritual power is coming, the golden age. He wants us to fully understand and grasp that, so that we do lose our attachment to this old world, but at the same time he wants us to be in it and demonstrating love. And that's a big challenge. That's different from just being away from things, like closeted away in a corner, or even the early Yagya years when that seed was planted. This is different. And I feel as if two things have helped me move towards this understanding. One has been very much a sense of the reality of magic. I didn't really quite get what the soul was for many years, I don't think. You know, I hear it, you're a point of light, you sit in the center of the forehead, you're a child of God. Okay, I would hear those things. They remained a bit conceptual, a bit idea-like, but not, on the other hand, huge experience of love in the early days, and from time to time during my journey, definitely, huge experience of love and peace with this family, but actually to sort of understand that I really am love. And really to then start working on what is it that gets in the way of my experiencing that love all the time. That's the task that we face now. We are love, we are peace, as that's the original condition that we have, and the original effort is to be experiencing that. So is that making some sense as a starter? Because I want today to be covering both some of the frontier science that is telling us that this world is actually a world put together by mind, and therefore this golden age is only a thought away, actually, but a powerful thought. And also just the reality of how liberating it is when we can finally free ourselves from the conditioning in our brains, where the ego resides and all the kind of wrong thinking that's inside us, and step into that beauty that is pure consciousness, of which Baba is the source. That's why he was saying today so strongly, remembrance is the only way to purify yourself. He said that again and again. Mary, how are we doing? Should I come in there?
Om Shanti. So that was a nice place to invite me in, and I'm going to wait for him to lower the volume. Today's Murli, because today's Murli was so connected with this theme that Baba says, remember me with love, remember me and love me, because we all know how to love, but we all have mixed love. And I like that you brought up Mama's example, because she was engaged to be married.
Oh.
And she broke her engagement. And if you're going to be engaged to be married, you have a lot of love, even if you don't know that person. Right? You have a lot of love. And she was able to shift that love for a human being to love for God. And I feel like this is really the crux of this whole journey, is that we're creating a civilization that's based on love. And how do we do this? We're all in our own way dysfunctional. And now we're all together. How are we going to create a civilization based on love and peace and harmony and justice and respect and all of these things? It's because we're all connecting with this one being whose love is perfect and unconditional and always there for us. And I think it's such a brilliant way, and probably the only way to get unity, is we all connect with the one who knows everything. And I was so amazed when I heard Mama's story, how you can be in this position where you think you have everything. You know, marriage offers such a prospect of having a perfect life with another human being. We can create our life any way that we want. We're going to love each other, support each other, be there for each other, create a family together. And then give that all up for the unknown, for something that's behind the curtain that you haven't even seen and nobody can ever tell you about. And so I feel this, is it faith? Is it magic? Is it trust? Is it remembrance of things past? This alchemy that motivates us to move from love for human being to love for the Supreme. Not that we're going to stay stuck there in love for the Supreme, but we're going to fully take advantage of that loving relationship in order to become a human being who can love fully.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, thank you. Fabulous. I'm going to put up a poem. I was saying that the point where Mary finished there is I think, of the essence of what we're trying to share today, to plant the idea arising from our experience that the goal in Raja Yoga is to become so free of the impurities, as Baba puts it, that and the alloy that prevents our love from showing through love for God, that then the love that is in us is able to come out into this world, even this old world, not with attachment, but with givingness. And that is going to be something that is of a huge value to the world as it goes through this potentially painful period, finally, of the old giving way to the new. It's as if Baba's setting this up like a beautiful mechanism within nature to make the transition as painless as possible for the world. And we have an important part in that, to be love, not just off the planet with Baba. That's the key. Now, just write this. I want to start it again in your nice writing. It goes like this, and it was written by William Blake, an 18th century artist and poet in England. He who bends to himself a joy doth the winged life destroy. He who bends to himself a joy doth, means does, Old English, doth the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And just to unwrap that a little, the joy as it, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And what Blake was sensing with an expression like eternity's sunrise is the eternal recurrence of the golden age, of newness, of freshness. And he's saying that if we learn to live in this detached but loving way, we can experience that even in the here and now. So if you imagine a joy like a butterfly is passing in front of you, and if you grab it because you think, oh, that's pretty, and you hold it like that and you bend it to yourself and you take a look, it's probably dead. You've destroyed it. And we do that with relationships and other things in our lives. We destroy them by holding them to us too tightly. This is the nature of attachment. But if we kiss the joy as it flies, it means like you love it, but you don't. You love with an outward love, not with an attachment that takes. You're giving, not taking. A kiss like this, you know, is a givingness. And that's, if you kiss a joy like that, as it moves, comes into your life and then moves out of it, Blake was saying, if you live like that, then the golden age of truth can be yours even now. You can live in eternity's sunrise, because that's such a lovely way to live. And what Mary was saying about how when Baba says, he said in the Muli today, remember me and love me, you're taught very little, simply remember the one Father. When we make that love for the one the focus of our life, that unlimited experience fills us, changes our thinking, and we start to learn how to be able to kiss the joys in life as they fly. We don't have to be sannyasis hidden away from life. We can find joy in life. And this is really important that we do, because we're not enviable to other people if we seem kind of too austere, too ascetic. I don't know if these words are providing difficulties for the translation. Austere means like stern and even unloving. You know, I can't have a cup of coffee with you because you're a Shudra, or you know, this kind of thing. Which sometimes we make these mistakes when we begin. Dry, that's good, yes. Yeah, Mary said Daddy often uses the word dry. And Daddy Janky is the opposite of dry, isn't she? She's made Baba so much hers that she's able to really engage with us in a very joyful way. Especially now, I feel. Now she feels that the job's done, sort of thing, as far as she's concerned. So she's chuckling away and really enjoying life after a lifetime of very strong effort. So this is really a very, very wonderful goal, that we learn to kiss the joys as they fly. And we want to think about, what does that mean? Is it dangerous? You know, does it mean that if I'm kissing a joy, I might sort of fall in love with it again and start wanting to bend it to myself? As long as there's fear like that, then I'm going to be constrained. And maybe it's wise to be cautious, because we know that we have sanskars of attachment and neediness. But the more we hold Baba with us, charging our battery, the longer we keep plugged into Baba, it's as if the energy flow will be from inside to out, and we'll be safe to love in this world. That's a good expression, safe to love. I think that's something we should all aspire to. Do you get that? Sometimes we can miss it. We can think that a Brahmin life means just love for Baba or just love for the Golden Age, but no. We need to feel that we are so strong when we've got Baba with us that we can love in this world. And we'll make mistakes, but that's okay. Just keep learning and keep loving. I'd like to just stop and check in with you if that's raised any questions at the moment, or if that's okay. Anybody like to pass a comment or question at this point? Or is it fairly straightforward? Because I think it's, for me, it's actually quite a new part of my goal, in a way, that I should be living with love out there, in a sense. I've always wanted that, but maybe I didn't have a clear enough relationship with Baba previously to make that a reality. So I kind of shut myself away somewhat while learning about the truth of who Baba is. There's always a danger when we focus on something that it grows, and then attachment comes. That's right. When we focus on something here in this physical world, especially with our sanskars of neediness.
So how to manage that? Because we have to address, we have to give the right vision to the world, the right vibrations, and we have to do the tasks. And not to hold on to them because we're thinking still we have to finish something. So this is then the dilemma that I'm not free and I'm not detached and loving.
Yes. Yes, it is a dilemma. While we remain needy internally, and while our relationship with Baba is still in the process of being established, when we really have that remembrance, when we've really learnt to keep the plug in the socket, I think we can be free from that fear. So the sooner we learn to really know who Baba is and really understand the overwhelming importance of letting our mind be with Baba, which is what he says every day to us, have that remembrance. As soon as we really get it, that, what did he say as well? He said, you're taught very little. Simply remember the one Father. It's amazingly simple. That's all he wants. We have to keep that plug in, and as long as we do, then the energy flow is from Baba through me out into the world, and I'm protected against that neediness coming. That's the key. And I think for me, one reason I'm really interested in this shift is that I see how it makes my life so much more enjoyable. Rather than feeling afraid that if I kind of too close to this person, I might get caught up in my attachments again. Or if I put too much into this work, my old ego element will come in again. We're right to be cautious about these things, especially when we begin, but hold in mind the goal that we should be able to do our role in life without that attachment, without that ego. And don't be afraid of the ego. You see, I think another thing is that we're afraid of our attachment, we're afraid of our ego. We shouldn't be afraid of the vices. If the vices come, see them clearly and say, thank you, you're reminding me. I don't want to let that old ego involvement in my work come back again. Or if you see it in a relationship, that the neediness is recurring in a relationship, then yes, of course you have to be cautious. But you can think, well, what do I need to do further to free myself so that I really am free to love, rather than to back away from things? This is the approach that I'm feeling right now in my life is so valuable. And it's a change, because I think that for some years I kind of was nervous of my vices, afraid of them, and sort of locked myself away a bit. Do you know what I mean? And I'm feeling now that I don't need to have that fear. Perhaps it's because I've understood more deeply. But I'm just holding this prospect out, because I feel it's such a... Even if you don't feel ready for it, and you have to be cautious if you're quite new, and the old sanskars of dependency and neediness are still present, then yes, caution is appropriate. But don't be afraid. You will get free of these things, especially the more you plug into Baba. Is that right?
I agree with what you just said about that, and I think it's similar to the way that we meditate. We meditate with an eye open eye, so that we can, we don't wait until we can really become self-conscious, and then we meditate with eye open, but we practice at the beginning with eye open, so that we can gradually develop the abilities that we can still keep self-conscious while we looking out to the world.
Nice point, thank you. Yes, I understand. I think the brother was saying that he supports this idea, and that it's also supported by the fact that we're taught to meditate with eyes open. Not that we need be afraid that, to begin with, our eyes may not have such pure vision, but we will be practicing it. You know, we have eyes open because we know that gradually we will be learning how to only be loving and not drawn by the world outside. It's a very nice point. Very nice point. There was once I was walking on Mount Abu and I met a Hindu chap from Abu town, and he was very interested in the Brahma Kumaris but a bit critical about them. And he was saying, "Are you a Brahma Kumari?" I said, "Yeah, I'm here from the UK." And he said, "Our quarrel as traditional Hindus is that we feel that..." Are you okay? Have you lost your sound? Is it okay again? Okay again? Yep. He said, "We feel that that the truth is there, but that it's something that you have to work for over, you know, many lifetimes, perhaps, and that when these daddies come and, you know, they give you drishti and show you that truth, like in Mama's song, they say that the people here are magic." You know, the Hindus used to be afraid of the eyes. And he said, "We feel that that's dangerous because it can make you feel that you know something that you're not really fit for." You know? It's an interesting objection. And I said, "Yes, I understand what you're saying, and it's true that I experience great bliss, not through my own consciousness, but through the consciousness of these senior instruments who gave me drishti. That's what made me a Brahmin in the first place. But I'm grateful for it because it's given me a goal. It's shown me what's possible. And yes, it's a struggle to get from where I really am with all of my interferences and that pure consciousness. That is going to be a struggle, but I'm grateful for being shown the goal." And I think he sort of understood that. But of course, the bit that is also, which Baba teaches us, why he says you haven't got many lifetimes to learn this, you know, this is actually the confluence age, and he comes to turn things round in a dramatic and radical and urgent way. So that's another aspect of the story there. Any other comments?
Absanti, remembrance is important, and Baba loves back me freedom and not be afraid. Can you share how to remember exactly? For me, I imagine a light and feel the quantity of Baba. So what else can you share?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the question. I couldn't quite catch it. Right. Yes, okay, thank you. Okay, that's good, because that leads me to the next section, actually, of this exploration. There are two things that have been especially important to me, and we're going to do some sort of workshop-y type aspects of exploration as part of the day. But I'm going to take a little bit more time to set out some of what has been so useful in helping me to have remembrance. Because, as I said, to begin with, my remembrance was in a sense false. It was true in that it was a true experience, but it was given to me by the power of consciousness of the instruments in London. And then it's been a long journey to feel that I'm able to really understand and make that connection myself. And two things I'm going to mention that have been of huge importance in helping me forward. One of them has been, I had the opportunity 2 or 3 years ago to catch up with some of the frontier science in the area of the brain and the mind and theoretical physics and what that's telling us about the nature of reality. Quantum theory, quantum mechanics was put out many years back, about 80, 90 years ago. You probably heard of that branch of physics called quantum theory, which they came across the scientists came across when they were studying what happens at the level of the very small. When you get right down below the growth level of ordinary physics, then you get down to particles and waves, the scientists found that mind comes into the picture very strongly and in fact is central to what goes on. So the scientists discovered when they were examining the behavior of matter at that very refined level that the quantum equation, it's called a wave function, would describe a whole range of possibilities of where a particle might appear if an observer came along to see it. But without the observer, it remains only as a field of possibilities. This is the essence of the discovery in quantum theory. Do I need to say that again?
Yes.
I probably can't, but I'll try. The scientists discovered that at the level of the very small, hands popping up and down, at the level of the very small, that is below the atom, they found that what we call a particle, for example, an electron or a proton, they found that it doesn't actually have substance. You can't call it a particle. Instead, it's described in the mathematics of quantum theory with a term called a wave function, which is very precise, but it describes a whole range of possibilities of where the particle might appear if an observer comes to look for it. Describes a whole range of possibilities of where that particle could appear if an observer comes to look for it. And that range goes from the highly likely to the unlikely, but still possible. And this range is enormous. From the particle might appear in your experiment in front of you or on the other side of the universe. There's a huge range, but the mathematics tells you the probabilities of where it will appear if an observer comes and looks for it. Without the observer, there is no particle. This is the amazing thing. So I'm going to read you something that was stated by Max Planck, who's the father of quantum physics. Very great German scientist. Institutes after his name, Planck Institutes, all over the world. And this is what he said, that after a lifetime of studying science in that materialistic way, this was his conclusion from the discoveries in quantum mechanics. All matter, because all matter is made up of particles, all matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force. We must assume behind this force is the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. This is absolutely revolutionary. Conventional science thinks that the mind is an emergent property of your brain. 98-99% of scientists think that way. Here is one of the greatest scientists of the last century saying that we must assume behind this force from which all matter originates is the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter. In other words, in Bubba's terms, it's the script of the drama. Bubba tells us that everything here, from a fly passing across in front of us, to a proton in the outer universe, to my hair, or lack of it, you know, all the things that we are and that are around us are all actually being put in place by a kind of giant DVD. Everything is recorded and exact, and that's why it repeats identically every kalpa. It doesn't just repeat by accident, it repeats because there is a force putting it in place, behind which lies the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This has, you know, understanding that this is frontline science, because I had a background as a science journalist, I suppose it's been important to me to find that the understanding of the soul and of the cycle and of a supreme soul is totally scientific. It goes against materialistic science, but materialistic science is unscientific. It leaves consciousness out of its story. It really is unscientific. So, you know, when you hear science programs saying that there's no such thing as the soul, or philosophers say it's impossible to have dualism, all these various things that they come up with, what Baba's telling us is totally right and supported by the greatest scientists. Einstein said something similar. He quarreled with some aspects of the predictions of quantum theory, probably rightly, because Einstein somehow, he's famous for saying God does not play dice. And the quantum theory did introduce this element of uncertainty about what was happening. So it says that until an observer makes the observation, it's not fixed where that particle will manifest or how it will behave. But in fact, if we understand that the script of the drama, that consciousness is fixing this play all the time, that removes this element of uncertainty. But Einstein said this: everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we with our modest powers must feel humble. So if ever you come across scientists or friends or colleagues who think that what you're doing is kind of irrational or unscientific, you can quote these greatest scientists and tell them, no, this is good science. And learning this has made a huge difference to my confidence in what I'm doing, I think. I've got a whole kind of stack of slides and presentations in this area, but that's a different topic. But it's hugely important to actually really realize that what Baba's telling us is scientific. It isn't imagination, like the BKs used to be accused of coming out with things from their imagination. It's not like that. It's real. There's a movement within science called post-materialist science, where leading professors of this and that are trying to tell the world that the world is not primarily material. The world is actually, this world out here is like a projection. It's the stage of the world. The reality lies behind. The reality is soul and God. That's eternal truth. That's who we are. What's out here is actually something passing, something fleeting, in a sense unreal, like the ancients used to say. The ancients in India used to say, all this world is Maya. Now, Baba reserves the term Maya for the vices, for the illusion created by the vices. But in a sense, body consciousness includes the giving too much reality to this material world. This material world is like a shared dream. This is incredibly important to understand. I'm just going to give one or two more quotes on this, because just to help you realize that there's a movement in science that is a real revolution. There's a professor, Richard Henry, at Johns Hopkins University in the States. He's professor of physics and astronomy. He calls quantum mechanics the most important philosophical discovery ever in the history of science. And he had an article in Nature magazine, which is a very leading science magazine, a few years back, in which he reached this conclusion: the only reality is mind and observations. But observations are not of things. To see the universe as it really is, we must abandon our tendency to conceptualize observations as things. This body consciousness includes giving too much reality to all of these things. These things are a kind of projection of mind. When you understand this, you can see the huge importance of taking charge of your own mind. Because your mind creates the world that you experience. Baba tells us this in different language. But you see the logic of it. According to how what I allow in my mind, so will be my world. There's a very lovely quotation from Marianne Williamson, a fine writer on this subject. From some 20 years back, she wrote a book called A Return to Love. And in that she said, thought is cause, and by thought she meant like what comes from deep within. You know, your attitude, your awareness, your state of being. Thought is cause, experience is effect. If you don't like the effects in your life, you have to change the nature of your thinking. And that's, of course, is what Baba's doing for us. We all decided we didn't like the effects in our life of our body consciousness, and so we're opening ourselves to changing the nature of our thinking. Marianne Williamson said, when there is love in your mind, it produces love in your life. When there's fear in your mind, it produces fear in your life. That's why we have to let go of fear. We must be bold. We mustn't be afraid of Maya. Yeah, a little caution, but Baba says, you know, don't ask me to send Maya away. She's there in a boxing match with you to make you strong, to help you understand. So we mustn't be afraid. We must really get out there and be knocked down by Maya, then stand up again and learn from it. This is how I feel. I'm a bit passionate about it because I feel as if I kind of hid myself away for a bit too long through fear of Maya. Although that's been good too, because I've learned about these things quite deeply. So I wrote to this Richard Henry, and I said to him, what is the meaning of 13.7 billion years of expansion of a non-existent material universe? Right? Because that's the conventional scientific view, that it started 13.7 billion years ago, which is very different from 5,000 years that Baba tells us is the quantum of existence of our play. So I said, what's the meaning of this 13.7 billion years? And he wrote back, it's just the way we talk about the observations, that is all. They hang together in a pseudo-physical story. So you see how beautiful this is. How everything that Baba tells us, suddenly you see the huge contrast with the falsity of a story that has been put together by materialistic science that leaves consciousness out of the picture. It's fantastic. It's really fantastic. He was ahead of the game so much back in the 30s. And we're still catching up with it, actually, to really realize, you know, just how revolutionary what he's telling us is. That just one more bit, that there was a follow-up piece that actually Dick Henry pointed to in Nature. Measurements are the only reality, say quantum tests. This was in Science magazine, the other top science journal in the world. Quantum mechanics insists that the characteristics of a particle or wave have no reality until they are measured, an idea that has long made physicists uncomfortable. Right? I hope I'm not confusing you. I warned you to fasten your seatbelts. Quantum mechanics insists that the characteristics of a particle or wave have no reality until they are measured, so that an observer is needed, an idea that has long made physicists uncomfortable. New experiments suggest more strongly than ever that they will have to live with that discomfort. By studying pairs of photons that have correlated polarizations, that's a kind of the angle at which the photon travels, a research group showed that the results make sense only if the polarizations do not exist apart from measurement. So, again, it's like an experimental confirmation that we see the world into being. It doesn't exist without us. Consciousness is so fundamental. And this brings home how important it is that we should ensure that we only have love in our minds. So this has been one of the things, in answer to the sister's question, a very long answer, but in answer to the sister's question about how do I increase my remembrance of Baba, the answer is, understand that Baba is truth and that love is truth. And hold on to love at all costs. Baba vibrates on a wavelength of love and peace and joy. And this is a very important point. I can't connect to Baba on any other wavelength. If I'm sad, if I'm worried, if I'm fearful, I am automatically divorced from the Father. So I mustn't give any time to such feelings, because they cut me off from that source that is renewing me. I have to be proactive in choosing to be loving, choosing to see the best, choosing joy, choosing peace, because only then will I keep the plug in the mains that allows the power to flow through into me, that then allows me to be loving in the world. I think I'd like to play another song at this point. Would that be all right, Mary? Did you want to come in with some? It's time, isn't it? Yeah. It's by a song by Cat Stevens. There is peace.
There is peace. You can taste it if you try. Can embrace it if you try. There is love. You can live it if you try. You can give it if you try. People walk this earth, people rush around, but there is no rest till their hearts bow down. There is a dream, you can reach it if you try, can make it if you try. There is a God, you can know Him if you try, you can approach Him if you try. There are angels, they are with you day and night, you can know them if you try. This world, I have seen the signs, but I will not rest till I pass the line. There is heaven, you can know it if you try, you can go there if you try. And if God wills, it will be.
Okay, I'm going to ask Mary to comment. When we did this the other day, she had an incredible capacity out of all of this kind of exploration to pull some key points. So I'm going to ask Mary if she could have a crack at that now, and then we'll take a break. And after the break, we'll start looking at ourselves and thinking about, well, why can I identify any of the things inside me that prevent me from keeping that plug in the mains?
I'm not a scientist, and I love hearing about these scientific breakthroughs. And as I was listening and thinking that, you know, they say there's nothing new under the sun. And for us, this is all very new, but I was remembering something from the Buddha that always struck me. And the Buddha said, the root of all suffering is attaching to things which are impermanent. And we can understand that, but I thought, if he said attaching to things that are impermanent, he must have grasped that there is something permanent, and that we need to attach or anchor, or somehow we need to be connected. And it's as if he predicted Raja Yoga almost, that we could think of attachment as yoga in a way. And I loved it that Neville said, you got to put your connection in the right socket. You got to get it in the right socket. And then we have to connect or attach to or identify with the right source. And then everything else which is impermanent, Baba talked about that in the Murli today. He said, all of this is going to end. It's all going to be destroyed. And where are you going to be at the end? If we have any attachment to anything that is impermanent, we're going to lose it all at the end. He said, guaranteed. So am I going to be empty-handed and fearful and anxious because I've lost everything that I've attached to? Or am I going to be peaceful and happy? He said, you can even be happy because I've got my socket plugged into the right place.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary. So we'll take a break now for 15 minutes, and there isn't tea provided here, but I guess there'd be time to nip over to grab a drink at the dining room if you need that, or at your bhavan. And then we'll reconvene at past 4 for the last session this morning.